Call for Action presents Of Consuming Interest, a public service show that discusses scams, deceptive offers, and other consumer concerns. Here's the director of WUSA 9 Call for Action and your host, Shirley Rooker.
The LGBT Tech Organization, which is a nonprofit, has started a program to meet the needs of America's homeless youth who identify as lesbian, gay, bisexual, or transgender. We're going to talk about that program today, as well as other things that the LGBT Tech Partnership does. My guest is Chris Wood. He is the executive director, and he is responsible. He's co-founder of the organization, and they have a new program called Connect for Life, which really could be very far-reaching for this young homeless population. Chris, welcome to Of Consuming Interest.
Thank you for having me.
This is a fascinating thing that you're doing, and I frankly was startled that there's so many LGBT young people on the streets, and what you're trying to do is tell us.
So I have to start back in my youth, when I came out as a senior in high school. In Alexandria, Virginia. My parents are both military and grew up very conservatively. And when I came out, I actually ended up in a disagreement with my parents where I ended up out on the street. And I had the only thing that I had to find a warm place to sleep was my cell phone. Now, back then, it wasn't a smartphone. It didn't have apps. It was, you know, the little black and white screens, and you played Snake on it or, you know, made a phone call or maybe sent a text message. And that phone back then, I didn't realize how important that piece of technology was for me, going from having a disagreement with my parents, coming out of the closet, to being out on the street and finding a warm place to sleep. That phone allowed me to call a friend, find a warm place to sleep that morning, get up and go to school, finish out my senior year, and completely change the trajectory of my life. And so looking back on that now and being in the position that I am now as the executive director of LGBT Tech, I didn't realize how important that was, and I didn't realize that today we still have an epidemic in this country. 650,000 people is an epidemic.
Yes.
And so when we brought on our research fellow from American University, Andrea Hackle, last year, I asked her to specifically look at this and what are some of the solutions that we could produce. And what she found in some of her research was that a lot of kids may have access to some technology. They may be able to get on Wi-Fi here or there, go to a public library. But as far as having a consistent access to a cell phone or some sort of technology, some sort of communication, it's nearly non-existent. Actually, if you look at the statistics, about 60% of homeless youth, homeless LGBT youth, have a hard time staying consistently connected. Either they can't pay for the cell phone because this month they don't have the money to. They may have broken their cell phone, therefore they can't get a new one because they don't even have money to find a warm place to sleep or get some food. And so being able to keep that constant communication with youth service providers, having that constant on that cell phone that's on, just was non-existent. Now, this program is a heavy lift. It's very expensive. We get no discounts that, you know, that people think that we do. We're paying $50 a month per phone, per line. And that gives them a lot of access.
I'm sitting here stunned. Mm-hmm. You're telling me that your organization is providing cell phones.
Yes.
To what part of this young population?
So we started with a beta test here in Washington, D.C. We wanted to understand, after doing some initial research by Andrea Hackle, we realized that there was professors at University of Southern California that had talked about if these youth had access to a constant cell phone or something to stay connected with family members, youth service providers, that they could literally pull themselves up by their bootstraps and be able to find a job, find a warm place to sleep, get back in school. And so we took that literally and began developing a program that put cell phones in their hands, that allowed them to stay connected for a period of time over, you know, 6, 8, 10 months. We weren't sure what that time frame was for them to be successful. By developing this program, we've really been able to begin to understand for the first time in a beta test format how this could impact their lives and how it could change their trajectory, just as my cell phone did many, many years ago.
So you're Connect for Life. You have a tremendous fundraising undertaking, obviously.
Yes.
You're a nonprofit, mm-hmm. so people can contribute and get a deduction to
Absolutely.
Your organization. How do they get in touch with you? What is your website? How can people reach you?
So it's lgbttech.org. It'll redirect you to our main website, and from there you can contact us. It has more information about the program. We're just in the beginning phase of this program, and we're not only looking at cell phones. We're looking at tablet computers, working with youth service providers like homeless shelters like here in D.C., like Casa Ruby and Wanda Alston House and Smile, to be able to provide not only cell phones but other electronics that can connect to Wi-Fi. So the nice thing about this program, it was built on similar models or minimum viable products like the way some Silicon Valley produces. Mm-hmm. And so we're able to easily flex it and move it to be able to provide the best possible solution to these youth.
So what you're doing then is giving them, as you say, a lifeline to the services and things that they need that they wouldn't have if they don't have access to a cell phone. And you'd like to expand the program. Do you believe that, well, let's put it this way. This is a startling number to me to find about the LGBT population that's on the street, the young people. Mm-hmm. But do you find that they're often there for a short period of time? Like you were very enterprising. You used your phone to find yourself what you needed, shelter, and enabling yourself to continue back in school. I'm sure that's the goal for all of these kids. Mm-hmm. Do you have any sense of how long they stay on the street? Does the study encompass the span of time that they are homeless?
So you strike on an interesting chord. It's different for every individual. And so therefore, it's very hard to be able to monitor, you know, how one outcome may be positive for one individual and another outcome may be positive for another. And so we're working with not only our program and collecting research as far as the individual's youth are able to respond in text message and respond to how the phones are working for them, how their situation is getting better. Mm-hmm. We're collecting that information from them in an opt-in basis. But we're also working with other researchers around the country, like Dr. Brian Samuels out of the University of Chicago, to be able to make sure we're comparing all the data so that we can provide the best set of information back to youth service providers and help them the best way we can. It's not a one size fits all. And I think that's the most important thing we have to realize is that every individual
is different.
And it's important that we provide them the tools where they can then empower themselves.
Well, I think your program is just awesome. And again, people can go to lgbttech.org. And connect with the program, find out information. You know, most of us are touched by people in the LGBT community in one fashion or another, whether it's a relative, whether it's ourselves, or whether it's a friend. So I think what you're doing is absolutely astonishing, and it's to be applauded. I want to talk about also some of the other policy issues. I mean, you're involved in a lot of different things mm-hmm. and issues that reach this community. So let's just take a brief pause, however, and let our listeners know they're tuned into Of Consuming Interest. I'm Shirley Rooker. My guest is Chris Wood. He's the executive director of LGBT Technology Partnership. And he is my guest. We're talking about some of the programs that we're doing. So again, the Connect for Life, it's a four life program. Chris, I hope you have the greatest of success with it.
Thank you.
Let's talk about some of the other issues, because there are a lot of things that are going on in the LGBT community that I think will be of interest to our listeners. And I'm particularly interested in something that you all identify as a policy issue, which is e-health. Tell me what that entails.
So e-health is really looking at it. The way that we interact with technology, and especially health technology. We have things like Fitbits and our smartphones and our smart houses. And the thing that a lot of industry partners are talking about is the Internet of Things. Health plays a crucial role into this, and doctors and healthcare providers are really looking at how can technology provide the best possible healthcare for you. Not only that, but how can it empower individuals to take control of their health? I think that's one thing that we as a society have gotten away from.
But that's just not the LGBT community. It infects all of us, actually, what you're talking about.
Absolutely. For the LGBT community, it's especially important because we don't have similar family structures. So a lot of LGBT individuals that I know who may be older, they don't have kids to then follow up and take care of them. Their friends are probably the same age as them. And so the older you get, the more important it is to be able to communicate with technology, be able to communicate with your doctors, Just think about some of the technology that exists today that can be in a home. If you're able to communicate with your doctors, say you're wheelchair bound, for example, or you just went through massive surgery, your ability to get online, email your doctors, your ability to take your blood pressure and send that immediately to your doctors, your ability to go ahead and, you know, say you have diabetes, send that information to your doctor. All of that information and not having to leave your home on a constant basis to go to the doctor allows you to stay in your home a lot longer. This is also true for the younger population. As you, as you're beginning to form your identity as a gay, lesbian, bisexual, or transgender individual, you're not going to want to come out of the closet immediately until you understand yourself, what you're going through, and what, you know, what your body is made up of. Looking for health information online is extremely important, but also being able to self-diagnose, because you may not necessarily want to come out to your doctors. Actually, one of our surveys found that over 50% of lesbian individuals prefer not to be out to their doctors, and so therefore they're therefore they're self-diagnosing without telling their doctor that they identify as lesbian, which could lead to issues down the road. So again, e-health encompasses a huge portion of what we're talking about when it comes to technology. And yes, a lot of it can impact the greater society, but it's extremely important when we're talking about LGBT communities because of they don't have similar family structures. They're keeping things to themselves.
I hadn't thought about that, but you're absolutely right there.
Yeah.
Because the family structure is one that often helps us as we age. And when you're aging without that same kind of support system, it does present a unique set of issues.
Of course, of course. And also the ability, just looking at e-health as maybe as your mental state, being able to communicate and talk with friends is extremely important to
who understand where you're coming from.
Exactly.
I mean, that to me would be a big issue.
Exactly.
Well, now, so how do you hope to impact this? Are you looking at legislation to improve content? No, it couldn't be legislation. What are you looking at to improve content for the LGBT community online?
So one of the areas that we're looking at right now is telemedicine. So being able to have doctors provide services over state lines. We're working with an organization called Health IT Now to make sure they keep introducing legislation with different members of Congress to be able to allow doctors to communicate over state lines and be able to help their patients. So an example would be if you identify as transgender and you live in Mississippi, but the doctor you want to see and who knows your case best is in Alabama. The ability for them to go ahead and help you over that state line is almost slim to none if there's not an agreement in place. And so telemedicine is an extremely important issue here. And that's one of the ways that we're really trying to work on Yale.
But again, I see this as an issue for the general population, because if you have a rare disease and you don't have a doctor in your state that's going to be able to identify and work with you, and you're limited in your travel ability, I can see where internet access to information reaches across the entire population.
Of course.
So
absolutely.
So what you're working on has that implications for the entire population as well as a particular community.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
and
that's great.
We hope that the work that we're doing in that realm will also help and benefit the greater society.
Now, one of the issues that you all have identified, which I don't understand, but I got this from your website, which, by the way, is lgbttech.org, was filtering LGBT content. Tell me what that means. I don't really understand it.
So every single month you pay your phone bill, your cell phone bill, and on that is a universal service charge, universal service funds charge. It's like $2, $3. That goes into a fund at the FCC, Federal Communications Commission, that then is put back into federal libraries or your state libraries and public schools to be able to support their technology. It's a huge program that has been in existence for quite some time now. When schools and public libraries apply for those funds, one of the stipulations that this Universal Service Fund puts in place under E-rate is putting a filter in place that blocks inappropriate content. Now, that inappropriate content, as you can imagine, you don't want certain things to be looked up in public schools and libraries.
Pornography, for example.
Exactly. And we agree with that. But what it also allows them to do, there's no standards around what these filters should be.
No, what they are. No real definition.
no real definition. And actually, it's not set at a federal level. It's not set at a state level.
No.
It's set at a county level. And if you or I were the chief information officer for that county or that school district, you and I would have the sole discretion as to set how those filters should be. So if you are very conservative and you do not believe that LGBT should have equal rights, you would be able to set that filter however you would like, which is a crucial problem. The ACLU has already sued a couple districts in the country.
But my goodness, having to do this district by district, I mean, that is a horrendous undertaking.
And this is why we began looking at this issue. We were working with Representative Honda's office. We sent a letter over to the FCC, all the commissioners and the chairman, asking why we're still allowing the blocking of LGBT content. Now, when I'm talking LGBT content, I'm talking access to GLAAD and GLSEN and the Trevor Project, life-saving tools and resources.
Health information.
Health information, as long as it's school appropriate.
Right.
A lot of those things are blocked. And so we worked with Representative Honda's office to send a letter over to the FCC, ask why this is still happening. We got a letter back saying that as of right now, it is in Congress's hands. It has to do with the laws around CIPA and COPA, Child Internet Protection Act, which are really important.
We understand that. You agree with that, right?
I completely agree with that. But there should be some sort of standard language about what should be blocked and what shouldn't be blocked. Because if a young person doesn't have access, or even somebody who uses public school and library computers, that may be an adult that may not be out, they're looking for information to help themselves. And if they can't do that in a public school and library, they're more likely to end up down a path of no return.
Yeah.
And so we've been working with Representative Honda's office and making sure that we understand where this is happening around the country so that then we can go have a healthy, meaningful conversation.
Have an impact on it.
Exactly.
Let's just take a brief pause here to let our listeners know they're tuned in to Of Consuming Interest. I'm Shirley Rooker. My guest is Chris Wood. He's the executive director of the LGBT Tech Partnership. You can find their website at lgbttech.org and talking about some of the programs that they're involved in. Many of the things that you're talking about impact the entire community, not just the LGBT community, but then some of it is very specific, such as the filtering of content that would be useful health information that is not accessible to someone. I can see this particularly where if you're in a small community, you're in this community, and you're an LGBT, and you have no place to go. How do you find information if kids may be afraid to search on their home computer.
Exactly.
You know, because there's the issue of, does everybody use it?
Right. So, and is that little link going to go from blue to purple? And all of a sudden you know that it's been clicked on, or the browsing history?
Exactly. So. Exactly. So I can see where it raises some real, raises some real issues for the LGBT community. Let's move on and talk about some of the other issues, the big data. What do you mean by this, and what is your organization's viewpoint? And I'm assuming you're talking about personal information, collection of data, which is collected about all of us. Mm-hmm. I mean, there is no privacy anymore. somewhat.
I mean, look, we engage in different online platforms all the time, and they're collecting data about this. If it's typically the rule of thumb is if it's free, they're typically collecting data on you.
Because nothing is free, Chris.
Nothing is free. But we don't necessarily look at it as a bad thing. And I think that's important for people to realize is that all of a sudden you're able, the health professionals, the government, nonprofit organizations such as mine are able to make educated decisions about how to better help their communities. And so I think first and foremost, look, we're very concerned about privacy and security and making sure that we're protecting individuals who may identify as LGBT. It's still legal to be fired in many states around this country for being LGBT. You can get married on a Saturday and fired on a Monday for being LGBT. That crosses my mind every single day. So I want to make sure people understand that when I'm saying this. But it's also important for us to realize that the larger data sets that are out there could have a serious impact on helping our communities as well. And so we take this double-pronged approach on it. I think it's important to recognize that President Obama has opened up 130 government data sets since he took office. That is a huge number of data sets that individuals like myself and organizations can begin to use. Now, there's certain things that are taken out and things that aren't accessible, But that information could be used to understand what's happening with the LGBTQ population in Mississippi, in Iowa, in California. How can we better help this state over in the west side, you know, the west coast of the country that has a high population of homeless LGBT youth? Why is it different there than it is in the Northeast? So all of a sudden, all these data sets can begin showing information that we could never glean before. An example of this, the CDC has partnered with Twitter on numerous occasions to figure out the spread of disease across this country because people tweet, oh, I'm sick or you know, mm-hmm. I haven't felt well.
I've and got can, the flu. I've
they
got
can
a temperature.
Almost track the flu going across the country by tweets going out. That is powerful information that we've never had before. So when we're talking about open data, we look at it on a couple different levels. Privacy, security, making sure that LGBT content is secure and LGBT individuals are safe in this country.
So in other words, it's not identifiable. It doesn't connect to you.
Correct.
It goes part into a database to send trends, to identify mm-hmm. trends,
right.
But not the individual.
Correct. Now, I mean, there are certain
in some cases,
in some cases there's yeah. issues there, and I don't want to neglect that. But I think we really need to keep our eyes open on the larger picture, and that a lot of this data could help in a way that we've never been able to help before on many different populations, especially as we have an older aging baby boomer population. A lot of them identify as LGBT, as we have younger youth who are less likely to communicate face-to-face like you and I here, and more over text message and Twitter and Instagram and Facebook or whatever it may be. And so I think that that information is crucial, and I think it's important that industry and government and nonprofits are working together to be able to identify trends and be able to, mm-hmm. to help our communities the best way possible.
So you want restrictions on privacy, but you want accessibility.
Correct.
To identify trends and so on. What are some of the other things that you're looking at in the LGBT community, Chris?
So we're looking at a couple different areas. One thing is that access to technology is extremely important, especially in our rural communities. So access to more and more broadband and spectrum. We work heavily at the Federal Communications Commission to be able to make sure that the LGBT voice is being added to the conversations there. The Federal Lifeline Program, you know, that is a lot of people have an idea that LGBT communities or LGBT individuals are very well off when in many cases, especially in rural communities, that is not the case. They're oftentimes even in worse economic positions than their heterosexual counterparts. And so having access to federal programs like the Federal Lifeline Program is extremely important. We're specifically looking at making sure that they're adding broadband or data access to mm-hmm. that program. And so there's a couple other ones. We do host an annual fall forum, which is going to be on September 22nd on Capitol Hill.
In September every year?
In September every single year. The nice thing is that you don't have to be here. We typically live stream it. So if you follow us at LGBT Tech on Twitter, you can watch from all over the country and you can engage in the conversation.
Well, you know, Chris, you all are doing some great things. I hope your Connect for Life program is really effective, because 650,000 homeless youth out on the street are members of the LGBT community is just astonishing. And I suspect many of them follow the same pattern that you did, that your parents, your disagreement when you decide to come out. And, you know, we wish them all the best and wish you all the best and really want to thank you for participating. Again, your website, give us your website and how people can donate to you.
Absolutely. It's lgbttech.org is our website, and you can follow us on Twitter at @LGBTTech. We send out information all the time.
Okay, Chris, you have been a delight, and I really wish you the best. Well, folks, you've been listening to Off Consuming Interest right here on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. My guest has been Chris Wood. He's the executive director of the Lesbian, Gay, Bisexual, and Transgender Partnership. And they are tech partnership, because you are focusing on technology. And we're just very thrilled that you could be with us today. Chris, if you want to get in touch with me, you can contact me, Shirley, at callforaction.org. That's Shirley at callforaction.org. And we thank you for joining us right here on 1500 AM. I'm Shirley Rooker. Thank you.
Of Consuming Interest is a public service program presented by WUSA 9 Call for Action, hosted by Shirley Rooker. Call for Action is an international nonprofit network of hotlines which offer free and confidential assistance. If you have a complaint, contact Call for Action at 301-652-HELP. That's 301-652-HELP.